This is Kate Magruder for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. About 50 years ago, hundreds of mostly white, mostly college-educated, mostly privileged young men and women, often called hippies, streamed into the hills and valleys of this county in search of a place to forge a new kind of community. For the past many months, my colleagues at KZYX, Sarah Reith, Alice Woofley, and I have been interviewing people to discover why they came, what they did once they settled in, how coming here affected them, and how it might have changed this place we call home. In the following half hour, we'll hear from Tom Lydon and Marilyn Mother Bear Scott, both early Back to the Landers who built homes and lives amid the oak savannas west of Ukiah. Marilyn settled on Greenfield Ranch, and Tom was just down the road in Compshe. Both have become familiar fixtures in the county through their art, activism, and community spirit. Here's how it all started for Tom Lydon, a Ukiah area commercial photographer.
I'm Tom Lydon.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Quincy, Massachusetts in 1948.
And why and when and what propelled you to come to Mendocino County?
I came to Mendocino County because it was an opportunity to build my own house, mainly. That was the first motivation that brought me to want to come to Mendocino County. And then, of course, there was the Vietnam War, the other side of it. I believe that the Vietnam War, which was happening right during my period of time when I was draft bait, and so many people were, and I think a lot of people had the feeling like, okay, how do we get out of this thing? How do we protest the government and make a statement that we can make it in this world without this government and without going to these wars? And I think that's really what started to motivate the Back to the Land attitude. So, and to me, it was a big issue. I'm graduating from college. It was the lottery period of time. Luckily, I was a senior. I would have been eligible for draft as soon as I graduated, but the lottery came up, and I'm in this real rural area in upstate New York, and I had this little radio. And I'm trying to listen to the birthdays for the lottery. And the signal was coming and going. There'd be interference, you know, and all of a sudden it would go staticky, and I couldn't hear what was going on. And then they'd come back and they'd pull some more birth dates. And I didn't know if I was one of those early ones during the static period of time when they're pulling or what. And then all of a sudden I heard my birth date pulled and it was like 330 or something like that. And that was just wonderful. I mean, and it let me the freedom to do what I wanted to do and to go to New York, experience that for a while, which I loved, and then get out of New York and experience the whole Back to the Land thing and being in Ukiah and in Mendocino County. So anyways, I had been living in New York City, had been about 2 years out of art school. I got a call from a friend of mine who had been in Northern California building a pottery kiln for a mutual friend of his. And so he was coming back to visit his folks for Christmas, and they lived on Cape Cod. He stopped in New York, and he needed a place to stay, so I said, come on over. I was living down on Canal Street in a loft, a five-story walk-up weird loft. And anyway, so he shows up, and he's telling me the story about this place in Northern California that he had been in, and he showed me some photographs, and I thought, this is unbelievable. And he told me, I'd never been to California, so he told me all these stories, these great stories about this place, and people are building their own houses, and so that's what really clicked with me. Ooh, living in the woods, building your own house, that's what I've always wanted to do since I was 5 years old. He said, I'm going back to California after Christmas because I got to pick up my car. I left my car out there. And I said, well, can I come back with you and drive back with you? Because I was recently unemployed. I've been working for a photographer, and he had to lay me off for a while, so I wasn't doing anything. And so I said, yeah. So after Christmas, we flew back to California, landed in San Francisco, took a bus up to Ukiah. It was all new to me. It was a rainy January day. We got into Ukiah about 3 in the afternoon. It was pouring rain. We walked all the way out Oar Springs Road to this place. It was like 18 miles on this dark evening, and I had this wool pea coat on they used to wear in New York, and it was saturated wet, it was so heavy, and it was dark, and we're walking through places like Montgomery Woods, and he says, well, we're going through some redwoods. I said, well, I've never seen redwoods, but I could feel them. I could feel those redwoods so well. So anyways, we end up at this wonderful little farmhouse where he had built this kiln, pottery kiln for this friend of his, and She was kind of expecting us and kind of not, but anyway, we show up there about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and she still had the wood cook stove going, and she made us some food, and I dried out a little bit. Spent the night, woke up in the morning in this wonderful little farmhouse. It was the old Wiest estate out Oar Springs Road that was built about the turn of the century. And it was a beautiful January day, and the sun was out. I look out the bedroom window, and here's this piece of paradise right there. And this is amazing. This is California. This is pretty cool. So anyways, that day, we were going to go look at some of these houses that had been built in the area, and we also found out that there was property for sale around here. So we walk up the hill, and we came to this piece of property that we heard was for sale, and all of a sudden, we decided, let's buy it. That would be 1973. So here we are, and had no connections. I had about $700 to my name. I guess I didn't know anybody here. But we're here. It was just the dream of developing this property, and that's the beginning of the history. You know, that's how it all started. And eventually we built our own houses, bought out a couple of land partners, and then just 4 or 5 years ago, I actually moved to town. But I spent about 40 years out there, part of the original Back to the Land thing. I brought the first solar panel in the area, and that's a whole story with John Schaefer. In the late 70s, and I heard about these solar panels, ended up talking with John and purchasing one. And I said, well, is this really going to work? And he said, oh, yeah, it'll work. I said, well, how can you guarantee it? So he, on his receipt, which I still have, he writes, warranted 1 year John Schaefer. And I still have the receipt. And the solar panel's still working. So it's, 76 to now. He said it was probably one of the first solar panels he sold commercially. So probably with the first 4 or 5 solar panels that were ever sold commercially in the United States. And I have one of them still up there on the property, and it's still working.
Who were your neighbors up there, and what were your relationships with them?
The area was kind of developed. There were many 40-acre plots that had been recently subdivided. There was a guy here in Ukiah who had bought this large parcel, I think it was 700 acres, and subdivided it into 40s. And so the neighbors happened to be people that bought. They were all Back to the Landers, Bay Area folks mainly. And we were all about the same age. We all had the same dreams and the same lack of experience and money, and we were just going to do it, and we all did it. And those neighbors, a lot of them are still there right now. And they've fulfilled their dreams and their goals and have been to Ukiah and created professions and made a living and had families and retired like I did. And I was thinking about that today. It was an interesting thing that since we were all about the same age when we started, we're all the same age now. And all these Back to the Landers, we're all kind of in the process of retiring.
Did you have any encounter or issue with building code wars?
Interesting. I got to know Barry Vogel early on, and he was involved with that. And he had some clients out in the coast and the Pygmy Forest that were getting red tagged. And I got to know these people. And I didn't think too much about it at first. I started building my own house in 1976. Didn't think too much about it, and I was so isolated and was so rural that I really wasn't worried too much about it. But I remember the other people that were involved with it and people that were getting red tagged and all of their issues. And I used to go to some of the planning commission meetings and whatnot and hear their cases and the wonderful stories that they told about why they lived where they lived and why they didn't need to have a coded house to live in. But then it was kind of neat. It was back when Norman Duvall was our supervisor. He actually initiated a process called a clean slate. It was before Class K. And this was a way to get all the homes that were built, uncode homes, established and recognized, and an opportunity. I think we had a window of a year or two to do this. And it was nicely thought out. It was an easy process to go through. And everybody in our community followed through with it, and we all went through this process. And so we had a visit from the planning guy and the sanitation per people and the tax guy, and they all came out and visited people's homes, and we were actually pretty impressed with everything that they saw. And because of the guidelines being pretty loose, everybody was able to pretty much get us accepted. So we all got accepted under this clean slate process. And that was probably happened late 70s, maybe 78, 79, something like that. It was nice that Norman Duvall took the initiative to get this thing happening back then, and he was well respected for having done that. And that was the beginning of the whole Class K thing, which came, you know, followed through a couple of years later.
Do you remember a particularly memorable character that you met during that time who was part of the Back to the Land gestalt?
There were the old timers that were still living around there that offered great information. I wanted to split my own shakes from my roof, and this old timer was a shake splitter back when he was young, and he taught me how to split shakes, and I think he actually gave me a fro, which was the tool that you used for splitting shakes off the shake bolts. And Dorothy Leonard, who's a neighbor, an old timer who had stories about, she used to sit in her kitchen and she kept a little six gun in her apron pocket, and if she heard a disturbance outside, she'd just shoot right through the window. So if you went to her house, I don't know if it's still there or not. The house is still there, but I don't know if the window was still there that was all blown out from her bullets. And she sat in this chair in the kitchen. It was a straight back chair, but she rocked in it all the time. And there were actually the two holes in the floor that were worn out from the back legs of the chair are still there.
I'm Kate Magruder, and you're listening to an interview I did with Tom Lydon for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Let's get back to the interview with Tom Lydon. Tell me some other stories about Dorothy Leonard.
Dorothy Leonard had this wonderful old house that she actually, I think she purchased it when she was grown. I believe she was married to the sheriff in Ukiah. It was this wonderful little old homestead out there. It was a shake house built in the late 1800s. She had, I think, 360 acres of some sheep farm there and an old barn. When we first got there, everybody talked about Dorothy Leonard, and at that point she was probably in her 70s or 80s, and we'd stop by and help her do things because she didn't have a car, and so we'd stack firewood for her and stuff like that, and then we'd stop by if we were going to go to town because we'd ask her what she wanted, if she needed anything in town, and she always said the same thing. She said, "I need a bottle of bourbon. I need breakfast rolls," meaning these, you know, these gooey, sugary breakfast things that, you know, that you buy, "and stop at the grocery store and get me bones for my dog from the Jap boy behind the meat counter." And it was that grocery store where the Victory Theater, there used to be a grocery store in there. And she always said the same thing. We always knew what she needed. That's what she lived on, I guess, were these breakfast, gooey breakfast rolls and bourbon and coffee. I know she had some caretakers there that got really sick because she had a shallow well, but she didn't have any problem because she had drank the water from there forever, but the sheep were all around there, and she had caretakers, and they got really sick, and they couldn't drink the water, but Dorothy never had a problem. She could do whatever she wanted to do, and she was just, you know, a real spunky old gal, an incredible story. And that's Dorothy Leonard. She lasted about 5 or 6 years and died. And she died, I guess, pretty much out there. They probably brought her into town at the end. She basically lived in her kitchen in that chair. And then in terms of the actual Back to the Land character, oh yeah, there were wonderful people. You know, people like Dennis Patton. I remember we had to get some water, so we were going to drill a well. I went to visit Dennis. I'd heard that he had an old well drilling rig on Greenfield Ranch. And it was the first time I met Dennis, and went there and found the place. And when I met Dennis, he was working this rig, and he was totally naked, but working this rig, you know. And I thought, this could be a little dangerous, you know, you can't get too close to this thing. That's how I met Dennis. He became wonderfully successful as a winemaker, and his wines are wonderful.
What did you do when you finally thought, I have to make some money? What did you do?
The other thing about back then is you didn't need much money to live on. Even, you know, building materials, you recycle building materials, There was always some way to do it. So I didn't live on much, but everybody had that issue about trying to make a living and living out there far away from straight jobs in town. Eventually, I decided, well, I can start my own photography studio here in Ukiah, and that's what I did. And that was about 78, 79. Had a little studio upstairs above Barry Vogel's office in town. And it was a great little space. And come to find out, it was Jim Jones's office at one point. So I was in that and developed the business, and it was kind of neat because during that period of time, everything was kind of taking off, and so I was part of that because I had expertise in commercial photography, both product photography and whatever, because that was my background at that point. It's when people, you know, John Schaefer was just taking off. I started working with him right from the beginning. He was still working out of his garage, I guess, or he had a little store on State Street in Ukiah. And I started trading my efforts photographing for him for products that he had because I needed solar products. And then, you know, Joan and Paul Katz of Thanksgiving Coffee, they were just starting. They needed help. I worked with them. I saw them grow. And then the wine industry started taking off. And it just was all happened at once. So It was neat, kind of, it was like being on this ride. When I first started in business to do commercial photography, I had some clients back east in New York, some publishers, and the closest phone to where I lived was, probably about 20 or 30 minutes away on the way to Comanche on a redwood tree. And it was just a little box, and the people at Royal Redwood Ranch had set it up because they had a summer camp and they needed some kind of emergency phone service, but somehow I got to be able to use it. So it was a rainy winter day, and I had to talk with this publisher in New York, and so I got in my car and drove through the rain and got to this redwood tree. I'm standing under the redwood tree in the pouring rain, and I'm calling New York, and I get the secretary at this publishing house, and I said I needed to talk to the editor, so-and-so, and she said, well, he's busy right now, but he'll get back to you. And I said, well, no, he can't. And she said, well, why not? I said, well, because I'm standing in the rain under a redwood tree. And so I had to tell her the whole story, and she was fascinated by the whole thing, and my whole life story and everything. And so she said, just a minute, and she went and got the guy going right on the phone. It was great. And then he wanted to know the whole story. And so anyways, he loved talking with this guy in the rain under, at a redwood tree.
How would you assess how the decision you made to come here, how has that shaped who you are?
Coming here made me who I am, basically. I think it was always in me. As I said earlier, from a young age, I always envisioned myself not only building my own house, but living in a small town. I remember watching cowboy shows on TV, and there's always these small little towns. There's a general store, and there's the post office and stuff, and everybody knows everybody, and they interact in the streets. And so I always wanted to do that and love that. And by being here and fulfilling all of my dreams and building a house, which I always wanted to do, and it was kind of like this big sculpture. And, as I went to art school, I was, I've always been an artist. So I was getting fulfillment out of creating this homestead. It was basically the biggest sculpture I'd ever made. And that turned me into who I am. And also, when I was young, I was also really shy, but it got to the point where I kind of wasn't shy anymore because this community, there was so much to do and interact in this community, so it developed in a different direction. I found myself getting very, very involved with community to where today I'm probably too involved. I was just thinking about that the other day. At this moment, I sit on 15 boards or committees in this community, and can't focus on anything anymore. I'm involved with too much, but I feel like I want to give back because they gave so much to me. My life's been really pretty fulfilling. I have no complaints about my life at all, and being here made me who I am, basically.
You were just listening to an interview with Tom Lydon. Now let's hear from Marilyn Mother Bear Scott, a revered spiritual elder who now lives in Albion. In the early 70s, Marilyn was one of the first settlers on Greenfield Ranch, west of Ukiah.
Marilyn Mother Bear Scott. I use the whole handle, and of course Mother Bear isn't a given name, but it's the one most people know me by. So, fondly known as Mother Bear, but Marilyn is still good. I was born in Philadelphia on June 8th, 1937. I came to California in the summer of love. It was communes that we were coming to in California. But before that, my first husband, he and a friend made mescaline in the basement. It was legal to get the raw materials, lysergic acid, etc., from England. And they ether wafted it about the household. And the first time I took mescaline, I have to say it was out of a test tube. A large test tube, and I was a skinny girl. And it was 1962. Then this whole psychedelia started, and that was early on when Leary and Alpert, who was later became known as Ram Dass, were still at Harvard, and I knew them. And because I was in the psychological, I majored in psychology at Bennington. I transferred to Bennington and came back and majored in psychology and theater and dance. And we had a theater called Boston Little Theater in Boston, and Leary and Alpert used to come totally, high as a kite. It was so much fun. All our friends are going to California. That's the place to go. And so we packed our bags. He was an engineer. He got a job on the West Coast that paid our trip, and we took our summer of love trip across the country. I came to Greenfield Ranch because I was at Peninsula School and everything was still in a totally like blossoming. I mean, what can I say? Well, Greenfield, for those people who don't know, is up in the 10 miles northwest of Ukiah, up in the hills. And our place was up a, we had to cross, we had to go up through the winery, up the hill, down across a creek that had no crossing on it, through the water, and up Radical Ridge is what we called it, Radical Ridge. And it was a big, steep hill, and we were almost to the top of the boundary of the land there. So we were definitely an end of the road a little, and no one was there. We had to get the laundry and stuff, and we wanted to go to town. And so we went, and it had been raining, and the creek, Eldridge Creek, had gotten flooded. And we had borrowed this Jeep, and we're on this one side of the creek. And I go, I don't know, I don't think we should do this. And Troll's saying, no, no, it'll be fine. The worst that'll happen is we'll just bump into the others. Anyway, we had laundry in back. I made Trent and Toby get in front of the laundry so that they could get out if such the worst happened. And I had Lasara in one arm, who's 18 months old, and my newborn baby in the other. The one film that we had was in there somewhere. We never retrieved it. And the laundry, and Troll was driving, and he makes a beeline through, three, 4 feet of water, moving swiftly, and hits a bank on the other side. And in no time at all, the water was flooding the car. And I looked down at my feet, and there was Common Sense Childbirth, the book, floating up with the water. I thought, right. And then we had to get out, and he got out and jumped on the hood. And then I had to, then we got Trent and Toby out, and I had to hand my 18-month-old baby out the window on my left hand where they could grab her and put her and then jump on the thing. And then the baby, the new baby, out the same way. And then I was the last, and I had to get out. I had worn, because it was January, I had this Russian military coat with these huge shoulder pads and stuff. The Jeep window was little, and I tried to get out, and I couldn't. I wasn't at my slimmest right after the baby's born, and they're saying, I can't get out, and the water is pushing the car now downstream. And someone says, take off the coat. And I go, okay. I take off the coat, and I finally get out this little window, get on the thing. I'm only a few days out of childbirth doing this, climbing onto the thing, up onto the side. And then we all get out. The car is there, of course. Nothing we can do about it. Someone else's car that we had borrowed. And we went up, and there was a some other friends who had settled there, left their VW bus, I think it was. Troll hot-wired it because they weren't there. And we went up to the main road and then said, okay, we're going to go to town. Turned left to go to town, and there was a huge tree across the road. And so then we had to back up and went to the ranch house, where we stayed in someone's RV. And I can remember the song that was, there were a few people holed up at the ranch house, about five holed up there. And the song, which is not really my favorite song, but still, it's resonant, you know, and this was being played a lot. Chain of Love. I'm so in love with you, honey. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the words right now. I'll remember them. Mm-hmm. You remember that song. Anyway, somehow it was significant to me. And so then he had to go and contact the person whose truck it was. And they contacted that sweet small guy who did a lot of work at that time. Anyway, he came and Troll met him and they dragged the thing out of the creek and put the oil out and did everything they could, and I guess it survived somehow, and so did we. We survived too.
I'm Kate Magruder, and you're listening to an interview I did with Marilyn Mother Bear Scott for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Let's get back to the interview with Marilyn Mother Bear.
I can remember standing on our own little hill there and looking out at the trees that were still there, and they're still there, redwoods and madrone and fir. We were at an edge, what they call an edge of the forest, you know, where things were kind of changing or had some of this and some of that going on. And I felt that I heard the trees speak. Mother Earth and Father Sun, thank you. We on Earth are one. This is my verse, the next one. Fur and feather, scale and skin, live on Earth as sacred kin. Scented flower, fruited vine, Lord and Lady, all divine. Mother Earth and Father Sun, thank you, we on Earth are one. And so it is. I know this, that the experience we had in going back to the land, of doing the back to the land trip, which it was, I mean, from the roots up, from the naked earth to the whatever we built, whatever we did, to the, you know, coming together and the separations, I know that it was a good thing, but it can't be done again, it seems. And I'm sorry about that. I know there's a lot of young people who strive for it. And I don't want to say absolutely it can't happen. It just seems like there isn't a milieu. There isn't a pot for it to fit into these days. And I know lots of young people want it. And I feel sad that about the world that they've inherited at this point. And I hope it can come around. And, you know, I'd like to really say I see a gold lining out there, you know, silver lining. A heart full of joy and gladness will always banish sadness and strife. So always look for the silver lining and find the sunny side of life. I don't know how I remembered that one, but there it is. I guess that's the final word.
This is Kate Magruder with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We just heard from Marilyn Mother Bear Scott and Tom Lydon. Promise of Paradise excerpts air every Thursday during the newscasts, and half-hour episodes start at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.